Hello, Dita. Welcome to the Creative Insider podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You can introduce briefly yourself and tell everyone who doesn't know you yet who you are and what you do and what is your background a little bit.
Sure, that's a difficult task for me to do briefly because I have quite a few hats. The main point for being here is, of course, that I wrote the book, Danish Design Heritage and Global Sustainability, and I chair the Danish Design Council. I come from a background originally from very different, more of a business background, went into circular economy just because I saw that there was an opportunity to move from a realm of doing less bad to doing things in a new way that actually wouldn't just be less bad, but maybe move towards doing good. And then, created a network on circular economy in Denmark with the Danish Ministry of Environment in Denmark at the time, Ida Auken, back in 2014, 2015. And then everything just kind of progressed from there towards really moving into design and in particularly architecture. So have for a number of years been very embedded with that within Linear, merged my company, The Circular Way, into Linear, started doing advisory for developers, but in particularly turning waste streams from other industries into built products. Because there's this beauty of the built environment having, such a large footprint, but also that's such a large opportunity. So some of the waste streams that were coming from elsewhere, turning that in, which was a beautiful journey of learning to work with architects and engineers and designers at large. So that also meaning that I don't come from a design background myself is kind of something that's just through kind of, how life happens, just became so apparent to me that if we really, want to create the change that we need and move towards somewhere where we can create value for people within the planetary boundaries, design is at the core. And from there, everything just else moved along. So now, a bunch of different things, but also then being the Chief Innovation and Science Officer at Bloxhop, hoping to move the built environment in particular towards, regeneration and at least towards doing something in a better way. Because the thing I think for me is like, I didn't start out in the built environment, but once you've worked within the built environment and you've seen how grand the problem is, it's very difficult to leave behind because there's such, the bigger the problem, the bigger the opportunity in that sense.
What really captivated me, because you have written other books already, you have your own website, thecircularway.com. It's that in this last book, you are diving into the Danish design heritage, a little bit in the background of Scandinavian design. And everyone that works in design and architecture, it's somehow influenced at one point of their studies or career with this philosophy. And I'm curious, in your book, through your research, what were your findings? What makes this design so special, so influential around the world? And in the end, what are the lessons that you discovered that can be applied for the future of circularity in the economy and in design in particular?
Yeah. I did previously do this book, A Changemaker's Guide to the Future, with Anders Linnea, the architect I work with, on circularity in buildings. And then during COVID, I had this sort of project of writing with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, this primer on, or this sort of piece on, designing for circularity the Danish way. And that was how it started. And then I sort of looked into, okay, what does it actually mean to design for circularity the Danish way? And it very much came from, you know, what we were doing in present time with circular building materials and designing for circularity. But it just a little bit, to be honest, by coincidence, struck me of like this sort of, okay, this tradition of Danish design, you have so much, and originally it was about furniture, you have so many brilliant, beautiful pieces that are still in use today. They've been produced in the 50s and the 60s. That's, to be honest, like the majority of my home today is made of those furnitures, and they still have value because they cared about use value, about the craft of the material, of of actually doing the whatever design you were producing, and then aesthetics. And then from there grew an interest, like, how is it that, you know, like today we just throw everything away? Rarely things are used for more than a few years. Like, why is it that they have that opportunity? And I think that sort of the actually just caring about use value rather than exchange value is a key component. Then there's this sort of form follows function, which is about the individual design, but it's also about putting the user first. So if you look at design today, maybe a bit too often we value the success of design based on how many items are, you know, sold across the counter, and a little bit too less of like, is it actually creating value for people? And that really for me became the sort of like what ignited the book, that if you look at Danish design and what we celebrate today, it's that there was this sort of like, it was a, like there was this sort of, you had the functionality of it, you had the aesthetics, but then you also had the social purpose, because when Danish design really thrived was after the two world wars. So we had a very clear social purpose of needing design to help build and rebuild society, create value for people, democratize and create well-being and just sort of welfare from an initial standpoint. And that wasn't something that was was a barrier that created a lesser design from an aesthetical perspective. On the contrary, it was actually something that heightened the aesthetical design of the project. And it is a key component to what we today celebrate as an aesthetic style of Danish design. So for me, that was super interesting when coming from that, maybe a bit too often today, we have a cultural understanding of, you know, if it's sustainable, it's, you know, it's uglier, it costs more, it's less convenient. When in fact, if we dare to use the planetary boundaries as a positive creative constraint, we can actually move beyond and deliver more than what we have today.
But what I noticed is that these pieces of furniture are definitely classics, but by becoming classics, they also become iconic, and people want to have them, and that's why they start becoming also more expensive. And also in order to make it so durable that it lasts so long, also the materials are of a certain quality, and that also raises the price. And of course, Scandinavia, it's like a very rich region, but the three points of sustainability is to be also social accessible for everyone. Are there some models of tweaking this economy that can make it affordable for everyone? I'm thinking about nowadays, it's very popular to have subscription models, right? Like you pay Netflix and you watch all the movies you want.
Kind of things.
And so maybe, I don't know, do a subscription to a furniture house that will take care of your furniture
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important point. And I think that the Danish design heritage actually delivered quite well on that originally, because I think a key component was also that Danish design heritage developed in synergy with the Danish welfare state. So there was this sort of a lot of, like, more people had the ability to buy quality, but fewer people had the opportunity to buy luxury or, like, frosting, if you will, in that regard. And I think that was actually a key component to, and in that sense, an example of a market economy that worked, because the societal model was, you know, on top of the market economy and sort of designing how, you know, what we wanted for the market economy to do for us as a tool. Because obviously, the book being Danish Design Heritage and Global Sustainability is not about doing more of the same. I think even if you go back, that was never the intention of the heritage. Carl Klint, the sort of original founder of the Danish modern, he was the professor who was the first professor founding the furniture school at the Danish Royal Academy, and he had this, I think for me, really nice notion of saying, you know, the future is built in the intersection between, and I'm loosely translating this because he said it in Danish, but nonetheless, the future is found in the intersection between the heritage and the tradition, being the accumulated experience, but in combination with opportunities of the current. And maybe what we need to add today is, of course, also the problems of the current times. So for me, it really, more than anything, comes down to that philosophical idea of design's ability to ask questions. I think if you look at architecture today, form follows function could also be translated to asking the question of why do we design buildings? Why do we build? Do we build because buildings are a fundamental human right? Or do we build because it's an object of speculation? And I think that's something that we need to, there's also an opportunity for, you know, get inspired and use the heritage to say we can do better if we are ambitious and if we dare to raise those questions and move in a different direction. I think it's similar, like for me, I'm at home right now, and the apartment was originally it was an attic that was like of no use, that Paul Hennings, the Danish lamp designer, turned into his studio and home. And I had actually not, I'm not a big fan actually of Paul Henningsen's aesthetics necessarily, so I hadn't really dived into him. But then with buying this apartment, I and the book, I dived more into it, and I found this really, really, for me, something that really hit was that he said, like in the 40s when you had the Second World War and Denmark was occupied by Germany, he always had a very strong social purpose in his career as well. He created this magazine called Kritisk Revue, so it's like critical revue thinking kind of thing. But he was also doing like songs for the theaters, and he created this song that's a very, very sort of like something that everybody knows in Denmark today. And it was a resistance movement song that essentially, again, loosely translated, is something like, you can tie us on mouth and hand, but you can never occupy our minds. And he proved that in the most brilliant way, because he actually sort of wrapped it in to be a love song at one of the theaters that was playing. So it actually passed German censorship. But then once it was played at the theater, because it was played to Danes who were occupied at that time, they immediately got the message and rose up and sang along, and it was like passed out through theaters without Denmark. But my reason for saying it now is that Then about 10 years later, right before he created this apartment, he was in the UK, and he came back and said, wait, like something is happening. We've kind of never been less free, because mass production somehow mastered to occupy our minds. And I thought that was a really interesting point of like, you know, sort of like that we've put the cart before the horse, and how do we recalibrate that of, you know, why do we design? Are we world makers, or are we in service to the world breakers? Why do we build? Do we build because there's a need from a human perspective for it, or do we build because there is a need to drive a new investment, and it's become an asset class in that regard? And so for me, that just became a really, really interesting journey of discovery and seeing that there's, you know, which is both a bit frightening and positive, but that some of the thoughts that have been going on for a long time, we still can learn a lot from. But it all comes down to our ability to question all of the things that we take for granted as sort of natural ways of being that are actually socially constructed. And then from there, the sort of the courage to then imagine something new and shape something new, give shape, and, you know, giving shape to something is there's nothing better than design for that. And then I think a key component for the Danish design heritage is then to say, okay, right, having a societal purpose is a positive creative constraint, not a weakness. And then the form function follows functionality as well. Very long.
No, I understood everything, and it's a great story that you did there, and the whole loop to understand what how the two resistances during the war, and then how this applies for design. But for thinking about it and thinking through seeing the different opinions, one thing also that helps me is that I have a very wide background internationally, because I was born in Bulgaria. I still have connection to Bulgaria. I was raised in Italy, and now I live in Germany, and I have more connection to Scandinavia and so on. Every single culture approaches this circular economy in a different way. And everything makes me think that the only possible solution to put together sustainability and economy, because on one side we cannot destroy the economy, because we have learned from the past that consumism in a certain way is good, because it makes everyone somehow richer, or there is more abundancy, but also consuming and generating trash is not the possible way. The only business model is some sort of subscription model, which is maybe also frightening, because it means not owning anything, just lending stuff. And I don't know, I can imagine about all the things that surround us. We get all these Amazon boxes, we buy this furniture from IKEA, which is also Scandinavia, but it's a different kind of Scandinavia, where you buy this furniture that maybe it's not of this high quality, but it's practical. In your research, have you also noticed or have created ideas about what could be also the economy of this kind of design? Because also architecture, that's a good question. It's a very big question now. Often, seen me as an architect, we ask this ourselves very often, if we need to build. In some cases, yes, because people are moving from, I don't know, different countries to the cities, or from the countryside in the city, and they have to stay somewhere, but you cannot move the houses. You can move only the people. So what are the possible business models or economical models that can this circular design flourish?
Yeah, and it's essentially where it really gets hard, right? Because this is about also you know, asking questions to the system and the things we take for granted in that regard. And so I think we all come from an economic understanding of growth, meaning benefits for all, lesser inequality and better opportunities for all. And historically, for a very long time, that was true in the Western world, and it still is true, I believe, for a large part of the world. But what we see in the developed economies, that stopped somewhere in the late 70s. Growth didn't continue to be a tool to drive improvement and well-being for people. It became something else. And so for me, it's you know, it's very popular of talking about degrowth and all these things. And for me, it's more about saying, can we reclaim growth as that tool we want it to be for what we want to achieve? So grow the things we want, stop the other things, but mainly saying, we do really need to reassess how is it that we create value for people while staying within the planetary boundaries. And we, for me, we are, it's a super difficult duality of doing better in the short term within the system. So like all of the different things that we can do within reuse, recycling, using biogenic materials rather than fossil-based materials, I think we need to do that. But at the same time, we need to be mindful and able to question that. Why is it? Is it going back to Paul Henningsen's point on sort of having our minds occupied by mass production? Is it of value for me that I feel, you know, if I need to go to a large party or if I have a large event, oh, it would be better to have a new shirt or something of that sort, kind of like, is that coming from me internally or is it something that has been created outside? And in the book, I touch upon it as well, because after reading that story about Paul Henningsen, I dived into some of this sort of, you know, what was that, you know, what was happening around mass production at that time? And there was this really interesting book by this sort of like pioneering American marketing guru, Edward Bernay, and I'm not sure I pronounce his name rightly, but something of that sort. And he wrote this book, Propaganda, which I think is also quite interesting, where at that point it was actually not a problem to call a book propaganda. Probably no marketing guru today would label their book that unless it was ironic. But nonetheless, at that point, it was no problem. And he's just very specific in saying, right, so now we have this opportunity to mass produce from a technological standpoint. So now it's my job to make sure that human desires fit the capabilities of the mass production system. And I think that, again, coming back to needing to put, you know, recalibrate, that we put the cart before the horse. Technology is, of course, a key component to the future, but it will not solve everything. And we need to recalibrate a lot of things in order for technology to be that solution in order to get there. And that's a super difficult challenge because systems change has always been extremely difficult. But we have never been at a place where it's been more difficult because we have such a centralized unity of power and resources to an even bigger degree than when we had, you know, the Catholic Church and whatnot being into play. And one of the reasons for me to mention that is also that I have this chapter on systems change, where I kind of start by looking back to Thomas Kuhn, who then, and this is sort of book on the necessity of scientific paradigm shift and scientific revolutions. This sort of very sort of easily understandable being that at one point we thought that the Earth was flat. And then we realized that the Earth was round, but that was a super difficult thing to do because one, it was extremely frightening. Two, what Thomas Kuhn alludes to, and like even, you know, Machiavelli and this book, The Prince, also says it so clearly. The innovator has no friends because there's no one really benefiting yet from what the innovator does, but there's so many that has so much vested interest in the current system. So it just goes to say that it's a really, really difficult task. But I do think that we, you know, if you fully acknowledge that we've entered the Anthropocene, that means acknowledging that what we do as humans affects the planet, and that affects our ability to thrive. And that's not sort of a side thing that you can put next to all these other scientific disciplines. That needs to be embedded in the core, and we still have yet to do that from a scientific and from a societal perspective. And that's a battle that we need to engage in long-term and be mindful of when we create short-term solutions. It should never be that we then sort of like say, oh, we should not do anything short-term because it isn't really the long-term solution. We need to also do a lot of the short-term thinking, but we need to be mindful of that long-term perspective because growth, yes, let's reclaim it, but understanding our societal value creation via growth as a goal needs to go away. Growth is one tool, one means out of many to assess our societal well-being, but it can't have the sort of overarching role that it has today. And I think it's, you know, not coming from the architectural or design background, but coming from a more sort of business school, but at a business school, also a very sort of political and philosophical part of the business school, studying Niklas Luhmann and systems theories, and sort of like saying, okay, there are a lot of subsystems, and then there's one overarching system, which is society, and then you have subsystems, which would be, you know, the capital markets, it would be media, it would be the political systems, it would be a bunch of different systems. And they all are part of the subsystems that make sure that the overarching societal system works. And today, I think we probably need to recalibrate that a bit so that we make sure that society, not the capital system, is actually the overarching system, going back to, again, you know, historically, you know, the financial services has always been a part of building buildings, right? Because there was a developer that saw a need and then needed liquidity in order to build that building. And then the financial sector provided that service, which makes a lot of sense, and they made money on that, and that's absolutely fine. But today, are there a fairly large amount of buildings being built because buildings today, real estate is to such a large degree an asset class that you almost have developers in service of the financial sectors in order to generate returns? I think that has definitely happened, and that's something that we need to be mindful of in order to really move towards a better world.
Indeed. When you say we, who are you thinking in particular of? Also, when you wrote this book, every time a person writes a book has a ideal audience in mind or an ideal reader in their mind. And you mentioned these systems, right? The different systems, how they cooperate together, but I'm thinking that this is a global problem that we cannot solve let's say in the most Western hemisphere of the planet. We have to solve it all together, and I think that the different countries are at different stages of this history. Maybe we are more further in the forefront, but there are big economies like India, China, Brazil, and which countries now are starting to have more money also in the lower layers of the society, and they want to consume more. So I don't know, who did you think about when you're writing the book?
Yeah, so it may sound a little bit, because now it's been like 2 weeks since I released it, and people are like coming up, oh, this is so great that you, like, you know, you really deserved that, that you have this success now after like all the hard work that you did. And it was like, yeah, but actually I just kind of really liked writing the book. For me, that was like, and I kind of like, that's so to some degree, I kind of, it maybe sounds odd, but I didn't necessarily write it with a particular audience in mind. I wanted to create change, but it was also that I actually really liked the process of doing it. That said, of course, as a Dane, it's something that I've, like, within the last 10 years and continuously are becoming mindful of my complete and utter blind spots of what is actually the state of the world. You know, we have this tendency to be like, okay, if we can just, you know, if you can just move before, you know, beyond 4 kilos CO2 per square meter in Denmark, check, problem solved. No, in no way. Because as you say, it's obvious, like going back to housing being a human right. If we take that at scale, what does that mean in terms of embedded carbon? Because that's a lot of people, that's a lot of buildings that need to be built in order for that to happen. And to be honest, that's still something that I'm exploring. And I hope that the book can be of use in that regard. I went with UNIDO, so it's the UN's Industrial Development Organization, so the organization that helps developing countries industrialize to, I went with them to Peru a few years ago, and that was such an interesting experience. They invited me because I'd done a talk at the UN where someone in the audience had asked me, you know, that's great, you cannot do all that, but what are the developing countries going to do? And I, in my answer, being a bit provocative and in no mean intending to not realize the privilege of coming from the Western world or the difficulties of being in the developing world at all. But if we looked at it from, you know, a not of all of the embedded socioeconomic perspective, but just that it might actually be a benefit that you haven't done all the wrong things. You haven't invested in all the wrong infrastructure yet. In Denmark, we have the, you know, it was such a great idea for a long time to create all of the waste burning plants in order to get energy. But that was based on, you know, we thought that the waste had no value and it was supplementing heat coming from oil and gas at best. Now we know that the waste can do so much more and we have better heating alternatives. But we have so much CapEx invested in those models and so much vested interest in that. So I think, which is so easy to say and so difficult to do, I hope that the book can serve as a sort of footprint for how can we rethink how we go about doing things, not taking everything that the Western world has done the last 50, 60 years as the sort of only way of going about, but challenging that a bit. But it is, for me, also very sort of exploratory grounds. I'll go to Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, in 2 weeks, and do a bunch of things, in particularly attending Unleash and our board meeting there, but also talking at, you know, to some of the universities and stuff like that about the book, which, to be honest, I'm very, very excited to do, but it's also a little bit frightening. Does it resonate what the book says or not? Because as of now, I mean, that's yet to, you know, I can think that hopefully it will, but it isn't until I really have that connection, which is yet to be had, that I know that it will actually be of value to them. One just very simple example is in my previous work with Linear the Circular Way, we took these Draftmaster kegs from Carlsberg, which is a composite plastic, and turn it into new materials, facade elements, tables, chairs, etc. And it was, from a design perspective, it made so much sense. That, you know, they had gone to the existing value chain. They were not able to see that it could be that it would be profitable to recycle it because it was a composite, so a mix of polymers. And for us, from a design perspective, it was there was, of course, also technical difficulties with it being a composite. But it also meant, because each polymer has a different melting point, so once you heat it a little bit, it actually started looking a bit like marble, because each polymer then had a different, like, how much it melted. In that sense, I think I actually have some over here. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Because I have them. Like, if you melt it a little bit, it would be like this, where you still have like a lot. But if you melt it a little bit more, then it becomes a bit like what of the marble perspective of it. And then, anyways, we could turn that into new products with design as the core. But why I thought of it now was because then we were approached by NGOs to help, because in not in Rwanda, but in Uganda, because after the Rwanda wars, there was a very large refugee camp created there, which, if you can imagine, like, that this project was 3 years ago, so, you know, the team, I never actually had the chance to go myself, but the colleagues that went, you know, they met people that were born and had given birth in the camp, which is, of course, not how a refugee camp is supposed to be. It's supposed to be temporary, and you can't build for anything but temporary structure. So you could imagine, like, they had this, the camp, and then you just saw all of the trees from there just getting cut down because they needed to build with it, and then you had rain, and then they needed new wood, etc., because it was deconstructed by the rain. So what we then were asked to do was, like, you have this very simple way of recycling composite plastics in the camps. We have a lot of plastic waste. Can you come help do that? And we did, and that turned into these sort of, like, so they could have these roofing elements for the camp, and that worked. But in particular, it worked because we could then have the Danish government buy it for a pavilion that we did for Denmark at the Milan Design Week, which Linnea had then designed. Because what was also, and what we had not at all thought about in our design process, and only came to my attention actually fairly later, that was an issue, that because you have your roofs as a very defining sort of element to what status you are at. So for your roof to be made out of waste, regardless of the function, was just not, you know, it was just a no-go from their perspective. But it was something, it was a complete blind spot of mine. So it was only later that I realized that. And I think that's some of the blind spots I still have on, in terms of saying, will the book work in a bunch of different regions? I hope that there will be value adds and learnings for all, but I think it's most likely there will also be some things that are not valuable, and hopefully we can all learn from each other and get better.
Well, I think it will have an impact if the book offers some ideas to achieve some of the needs that these people have in a better way, for inconvenient way for them, I think. But I mean, that's only for the readers to say after they have gotten access to the book. You said that you loved the process also of writing a book. I'm curious, what was your process? How long it took you to write the book, and how did the research you did look like? Because I guess it's a heavily researched book based on a lot of research.
Yeah, I mean, it was 2.5 years, I think, in total, which of course was like not only book. There was a lot of other things going on, and I think that's that gave value, but it also made it more difficult because I think Routledge, the publisher, normally they have like professors that's done a course a number of times, and they turn it into books, so they know what they want to put in. For me, the process of writing the book was actually also aligning my own thoughts and getting comfortable with my own thoughts. So in that sense, I also changed a bit along the way, kind of like how I saw things or how I felt that things should be framed. So I actually handed in the book the first time last summer, took it back because I wasn't comfortable with it after the summer holidays. I was like, something is missing. And then I thought, oh, I just need to write this chapter and then everything will be as I wanted. But then you kind of like revisit things. And then I wanted, and essentially like that was, I did that in September, and I did like some new, like two new chapters. And just like in my gut, I just didn't feel like fully comfortable with it. So after Christmas this year, I went to our summer house on the island of Bornholm, where my dad is originally from. So I've been there a lot throughout my childhood and also adult life, and really love it. The nature there is just amazing and also quite different and more rough than you have in anywhere else in Denmark. So it's just like, for me, it's like the perfect place to be in January. This sort of little town where the summer house is at is very beautiful. You have like, you have the sea, you have the forest, but you also have the Hammerknuden, which is a key natural component. But it also means that there is absolutely nothing going on in January. There's just dark, and people aren't really even home, because that's also their opportunity to take holiday, because it's a little bit, you know, you have, you know, it's seasonal, so you have tourists in the summer. So you work during the summer if you're local. But anyways, I went there and I wrote on it, and then I had like, I think I'd been there for, I had like 2 weeks, and like the first week when I finished that, like Friday evening, I sat and I was like, there's something. And then I created like, I was like, I had this sort of the overall structure in Google Docs, and I just created a copy and said this sort of like the reimagined version of it. And then I moved all of the chapters around, and then I went to bed, and then I woke up the next morning and realized, yeah, it should actually be the new version where the chapters are completely differently structured, and that makes me feel so much better on it. So it's yeah, but it's yeah, as we talked about, I did do the A Changemaker's Guide to the Future in the book in 2018, which was only built environment and circularity with Anders Linnea, and it was published by the philanthropic organization Realdania. So there wasn't a publishing house, and there wasn't the rigorousness of a publishing house, for better or worse. So it's a very different process, but I like that process. I came out of that thinking, ooh, if I'm going to do this again, I'm going to do this and this and this thing differently. And in this process, I came out with the same feeling of saying like, ooh, maybe I should try this again, and then I will do this and this and this thing differently. And I think that's, I won't write a new book anytime soon, but hopefully I'll remember to take the learnings that I want to do similar, but also the things that I want to do differently if I do it again.
How do you write the book? You started with this core idea, which is the now somehow translated in the title of the book. Do you set up what you think, what are the main topics, and then research on them, and then cluster the topic somehow in chapters? Because for someone that hasn't written a book like me, it sounds a very frightening process to start on a blank page and fill those pages with different topics.
Yeah. And actually, that's like at one point I want to try that process of starting on a blank page, because I've never done that. I've always had maybe I've written a opinion piece for somewhere, and then I have like a piece here and a piece here and a piece here, and then that's sort of like a core frame, and then I write new things and I mix everything together, which I think I've needed in order to just be able to do it, but. But I actually kind of dream of that sort of like one day going to Bornholm or somewhere similar, just sitting for 3 months, starting on a blank piece of paper, having that sort of going back to, having the planetary boundaries as a positive creative constraint, having a positive creative strain. I cannot, use anything, no reuse whatsoever, just need to start completely over, but I'm like you, that would be so far that would have been like so daunting, and so as of now it's been saying like, yeah, okay, I have these ideas, I have these sort of like things from here and here, because yeah, like what you're saying with starting with a blank piece of paper, that's just been too daunting. So I've always started with saying like, I have something here and I have something here and I have something here. And then it's a bit sort of more doable to write the in-betweens.
Yeah, connecting the dots. And do you struggle with sitting and writing actually? Because there is this, it's renowned that it's somehow frightening, to sit every time and write. Do you struggle with that, to sit down and write? Or if yes, how do you overcome this? Or is it always for you very pleasant to sit and start playing with your thoughts?
I wish it always was. It isn't. However, what I really like, if I go away and go be secluded, then I've actually never experienced that it wasn't pleasant. The problem for me is if I think that I can, wake up a bit early and just write for 2 hours and then go about doing daily life and be in the city and stuff like that, then I sit and, either I'm not able to write anything, or I feel like what I'm writing is just like really, really bad, and it just becomes this sort of negative thought spiral of some sorts. So I definitely recognize that for me the tool is really like, it takes time to get into that sort of energy and space, and you need, more than anything, you need to leave your phone very, very, your phone, all types of social medias very far away, and just be with the thought process of writing. But luckily I've never experienced, if I give myself that opportunity and really do that, then I've always found it pleasant to write. But I've definitely had more than a few of not, of just feeling like whatever, like how much I tried and sort of like, and it was just like there was nothing that I found to be of interest or value, or it just sounded stupid kind of, and there was like nothing interesting popping up. So my advice would definitely be to take the time, remove yourself from all of the daily stimuli that we have, and allow yourself to be in that process. And then I think it's a balance. I have, like as mentioned, I have this sort of like this dream of the blank page, but at the same time also knowing that I would not, like, even if I had that opportunity, I would not have yet to be able to write that. So maybe it's also, you know, starting somewhere and then realizing that it's a journey. You don't get from 0 to 100 in the first instance.
And do you have some method of journaling, also like writing per hand down things? Do you have some method to do that? Because yeah. I know that a lot of writers use some form of journaling, or do you do it also for you personally? I don't know if you can expand on that.
Yeah. I have my journal that I for me, like, remembering is very much writing by hand. So I prefer to have my journal in all things. And then it's the journal is where you sort of, like, you have like these buttons where you click in the new round of paper, and then I put the old rounds of papers in sort of like they're all stacked together. But yeah, for me, for sure, journaling that's about writing, but it's also just my way of processing thoughts. I know, and people continuously laugh at me because, like, do you realize how much easier it would be if you had a Google Docs, or if you had like a note system and you could just like categorize everything and you just have things automatically at the computer? And I fully acknowledge that would, and there are many times when I wish I had done that, when you need to get something just done quickly, for sure. But for me, I writing in hand, having my journal and knowing that I stack everything, and I do actually go back to my old journals and look through them when I need to be, you know, remember something. So for me, that's absolutely key and something that I hope I never have the desire to change.
No, yeah, definitely. Also, I think that Google Notes or all these digital tools, you cannot think the same way when you're typing things. It's different when you write down. It's much quicker. It's like, you know, you put your thoughts directly in your fingers, and it's a completely different process than that. And what has been the, so how did you have a publisher, I guess? You're not self-publishing the book. Do you have any feedback? Because also you are now, like, it's not your first book. It's like your third book, if I'm not wrong. But I'm sure there will be a third. So, what kind of people have reached out to you, or what publishers are saying? Do they give you some goals to publish your book, that it has to sell so many copies, or how does it work, that thing? Because it's a very specific book.
Yeah. Well, the first book was, that was financed by the philanthropic organization Realdania on getting our experience with building with circular materials and building the circular way out. So there was no, like, it was financed by them, but there was no publisher. So we could, you know, we'd given the sort of, like, you know, the application, but we could then kind of do as we wished, which had a lot of benefits, but also, of course, some constraints, because we were not, you know, it's not our skill set in our profession. This book was by Routledge, which is a very sort of rightfully esteemed social science and other sciences academic publishing house. And I chose them for that reason, because I think I have a little bit of sort of, you know, sort of like I'm looking into this, to the world of science, and I'm a little bit envious of them, or I'm a little bit sort of like they're my idols. So I kind of want, so I was very, yeah, I wanted that academic proof
approval,
in that sense. So I approached them and said I have this idea, and they had previously saw the first book, but had been interested in that. But given that that was open source, it wasn't really and it turned out not to really be an interesting thing to publish for a publisher, of course. We talked when I had that idea. I went to them and they luckily went for it, and I knew that due to their sort of standing within the academic science sort of realm, that was who I wanted to go with. So I was very happy with that. But that said, with everything, you know, you have like, I chose them for that. And then you know, there's like, you have that, this view, but then of course there's all these things that you don't see. And there was very much also that I really appreciate them, especially the editorial team. When it went to the production team, I had lots of struggles in, you know, that was never the purpose of the book. But then you go into sort of like, you know, you have an editorial team, which is like, you know, they're the ones who've gone to the editorial commission and said, we should publish this. They're the ones who know you, get the vision, and there your line goes to production. It's a little bit more like everything else, and then you become like, then it was a little bit more treated as their traditional academic book, which by no means it's not. I don't have that capability, but I hope and I do believe that I have a lot of other capabilities coming from practice in that sense, but there was quite a bit of struggle of making sure that I could keep my tone of voice and that perspective in that regard, which I understand. It was just that it was a blind spot that I hadn't been mindful of. So, you know, maybe if I do a third book, it might make sense to do a little bit less of an academic rigorous publishing house, somewhere in between, maybe.
Maybe you could also. I've talked to many people now that you can. Now it's quite easy to be self-publisher for a book. There are many tools, and actually, it's so funny because Amazon. It's usually the worst, the worst corporation for sustainability. But in terms of self-publishing, it's quite sustainable because then they have the smart thing that they print only the books that get ordered. So it's super interesting concept.
Yeah. For me, like one, this book, I think it would have been like in the sense of how I leaned in and how I was on my own, I think I would have been difficult to be comfortable with that from a self-publishing perspective. So I kind of like needed that proof from their side to really feel comfortable putting those thoughts into paper. And then the other side, they were also in the editorial part really, really good before we made the final agreement. Like they had, you know, three professors that I was actually never allowed to know who was, because they hired them to be anonymous so that they could really feel comfortable of just, you know, saying whatever they felt about this synopsis and what I wanted to do with the book. It was prior to the book being written. But they then luckily felt that it was a good idea and I was a good person to write it. But they also came with so many, you know, like, okay, she's trying to do too much. She should really like focus. This is the part that's super interesting. And then, by the way, this is the new research coming out in that and that and that. She should read that. And for me, like, you know, it was due to them that I got all of that really, really nice feedback on my synopsis, but also on super relevant new research coming in. And that was like, you know, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, get that myself or become acquainted with that myself. So I think, who knows in the future, but I don't think necessarily self-publishing is for me.
And to conclude a little bit our conversation, what do you hope to see in the next years as trends in the different design industries for more circularity? Or what are your expectations in the future in this kind of field after all the background or your work and your research you have done?
I hope so much that, whatever I say today, I will be blown away because I don't have the ability to imagine what will be the sort of future of design 3 years from now. With that, I mean that design really leans into that opportunity of being world makers rather than world, in service of world breakers, that there's a little bit too much of a tendency today. But it all comes down, for me, success comes down to, are we able to create value for people while staying within the planetary boundaries or not? And if we're not, then designers need to say, hey, guess what? Time is our most precious resource. If this project ain't doing that, then I need to do something else, because spending time on things that aren't moving us in the right direction is de facto a bad choice.
Yeah. Well, I hope so too. I think that from my perspective, somebody that works in the field of architecture and working even in Germany, which is a little bit of a more conservative and slower to develop new things country, it's a big topic, and people are working on it, and we are working on it, and it's not just we're not trying to do greenwashing. We are trying to really find a feasible solution that will be sustainable according to the ecological sustainability, economical, and also for the social sustainability. So I think it's changing, and I'm happy that there are also people like you that put even the needle a little bit further, so that it's makes us think a lot.
Yeah, no, I think that's, and I think that's great. And I think it's like, it's very easy to write a book about what things should ideally be like. That doesn't mean that that doesn't look exactly like that isn't great. Like, I think for me, more than anything, we need to be biased towards action. So even the smallest steps are worth celebrating, as long as it doesn't become greenwashing, which for me means that we say, yay, I used this amount of recycled material, then it's perfect, or thus it's sustainable. No, of course not. We're all on a journey. Like, I think, we have yet to really fully produce that, sustainable building to that degree. So finding that balance of like, where do we want to go long term, but also recognizing that, all the work that everyone does little by little is the necessary steps that we need to take, because otherwise we're never going to be able to create that shift. So I think that's great.
Yeah.
Me too. In a conservative German industry.
Well, I'm wishing you all the best for the book. I hope that many people will read it and that it will have a positive response. And I say to every guest of the Creative Insider, this was your first time on the podcast. But of course, it doesn't have to be the last one. And whenever there are some news around what interests you, or around a new book or some new activity you're working on, you're always welcome on the stage to talk about it. And thank you very much for spending a pleasant hour with me and the audience of the Creative Insider.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope in like maybe, a year's time, I'll come back and sort of like, how did it work on a global scale with cultures different from, the European culture?
That would be super interesting. You're very welcome to, that would be a very interesting discussion. So you're always welcome back. You just text me and we're going to make it happen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. Thanks.